Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporation, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 4th, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the ongoing litigation surrounding the proposed AT&T and Time Warner merger. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us the Honorable Joshua Wright, who is a former FTC commissioner and is the current Executive Director of the Global Antitrust Institute for the Antonin Scalia School of Law. After hearing from our speaker, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Josh, the floor is yours.
Thanks, and thanks for having me. I thought what I might do is briefly do a short background on the case in the district court decision, but spend most of the time talking about the arguments on appeal, but a little bit of background for those less familiar. So the acquisition was announced in October 2016, AT&T was paying approximately $85 billion for Time Warner. In November 2017, DOJ filed its complaint seeking to block the transaction and alleged, sort of really had a couple of theories about, alleged in the complaint about why the transaction might give rise to a violation of Section 7 of the Clayton Act by substantially lessening competition in the sale of video programming and distribution, sort of one of those theories being that the transaction might enable AT&T to use Time Warner's television content to raise its competitors' video programming costs, and the other by potentially withholding what the DOJ complaint describes as must-have Time Warner content to drive those same competitors' customers to AT&T's new post-merger subsidiary. By way of background, and I think it's worth noting because some of this will come into the discussion of the appeal, and a couple of the things that I think are interesting about the appeal. I know for antitrust academics like myself, one of the really interesting features about the case is how rarely we get a vertical merger litigated sort of fully. So I think sort of off-cited that as the first fully litigated merger challenge in 40 years. You know, I'm an antitrust casebook author, so always in the market for fully litigated opinions to shop around for the book and to have something to teach about how courts and agencies engage in antitrust analysis and in the vertical merger space. That's been slim pickings for a while. Judge Leon's 172-page opinion certainly is important for at least that reason. Also, I think because as the FTC hearings are going on at the moment, including panels on how the agencies ought to be thinking about vertical mergers going forward, discussion about whether we need or don't need vertical merger guidelines. I think certainly a timely topic for any one of those reasons. So following the six-week trial, Judge Leon issued a detailed opinion, 172 pages again, that rejected DOJ's arguments that the combination would violate Section 7 of the Clayton Act. I wanted to, before sort of jumping into the arguments on appeal, highlight a couple of things that I thought were particularly important in Judge Leon's opinion that I think sort of tee up some interesting discussion for the appeal. The first, and it's a relatively basic point, but I think an important one, one of the big differences between vertical merger litigation and horizontal merger litigation, that is the way that courts analyze mergers between competitors as opposed to those between firms that are complements or in the same supply chain, sort of vertical mergers like AT&T, Time Warner, is there's an important legal distinction between the two. In the case of horizontal mergers, analyzed under Section 7 of the Clayton Act, the government can avail itself of something we call the PNB presumption, named after the Philadelphia National Bank, a Supreme Court case in 1963, in which the court said, we're going to have a sort of magic number threshold in terms of post-merger market share, that if the government can show that the post-merger share is above 30%, then we're going to automatically allow the government to dispel its prima facie burden of proof and shift the burden to the merging parties to show pro-competitive benefits. The agency guidelines rely on other sorts of evidence, economic analysis, customer testimony, all sorts of other things. So by no means in horizontal cases do the FTC or DOJ rely solely upon sort of market share statistics to get the job done, so to speak. But it is true that such a showing, just sort of a plain market share showing and a rather modest one with a post-merger share above 30, allows the government to shift the burden. In reality, that burden shifting mechanism, that sort of PNB presumption, is pretty important in practice. There are very few instances in which the government has lost after shifting that burden. An interesting contrast to vertical merger cases where the government does not benefit from that presumption of illegality that derives from PNB. And so we haven't seen a fully litigated challenge or what litigation might look like without that PNB presumption. Without a structural market share presumption of legality, the case was always going to turn on sort of other forms of evidence, whether it be customer testimony or economic analysis. And that, I think, is an important precursor to understanding Judge Leon's decision, sort of 172 pages, of which 130 or 140 are digging into, in a pretty detailed way into customer docs and economic inputs and the like. Another thing that I think is important observation is oftentimes in merger cases, but not always, we've got battles around what describe as hot documents, right? So business documents that suggest one way or another either the purpose or effect of the transaction. Most of the time, documents featuring sort of enticingly boastful rhetoric about the effect of the transaction. The DOJ relied extensively on ordinary course documents, prior regulatory filings to support their increased leverage theory, describing it as real-world objective evidence and claiming in the briefs and during trial that anti-competitive intent can be a sort of divined from these documents, can be a pretty useful way of predicting anti-competitive effect. Judge Leon's opinion finds little probative value in those documents, dismisses some of the documents produced by lower-level employees as irrelevant to understanding what the parties were likely to do after the merger or in the absence of the merger, rejected the DOJ's reliance on prior regulatory findings as being not probative to understanding the economic effects of this transaction. And so not inconsistent with other merger opinions we see from time to time in the horizontal space, but I think certainly worth noting that Judge Leon's opinion placed a low value on predictions in business docs or boastful rhetoric from executives or statements made about prior mergers to other regulatory bodies. And instead, I think, focused greatly on weighing and understanding economic evidence and analysis. Indeed, I think probably a central theme in Judge Leon's opinion is a fight over economic analysis, and certainly in the DOJ's appeal brief, and we'll turn to that in a moment. I think certainly quite a bit of that fight over how to interpret economic analysis and evidence really plays a central role in Judge Leon's opinion, and no doubt also will be important in the way the D.C. Circuit evaluates the appeal. The court, I think, engaged very closely with the economic evidence, discussed the experts' models, testimony, their conclusions in length, did more work than I think is normally done in evaluating the quality of inputs to the models the various experts use. Judge Leon expressed a great deal of suspicion about particular applications of the DOJ expert, Carl Shapiro. The bargaining model that he applied to the merger at hand, questioned inputs to the model, questioned the fit of the model to the particular case at hand, spent about 40 pages of his opinion sort of critiquing the model's inputs and assumptions one by one in various places, taking issue with either input sources or methodology, which he at one point describes as significantly flawed. Three of the inputs to those models, the long-term subscriber loss rate, that's the number of subscribers that would leave the current TV distributor if Time Warner withheld content, the diversion ratio, sort of a big important input in most antitrust cases, including merger cases. He took issue with the lifetime value of customers. He took issue with inputs that Dr. Shapiro used in his model with respect to each of those, and indeed credited testimony from the party's expert, Dr. Carlton, Dennis Carlton, that most of the DOJ's results would go away if you even tweaked sort of one or two of these inputs or assumptions. And so at the end of the day, Judge Leon's analysis sort of found not only the inputs and assumptions used in the model, sort of rejected its predictions because found the inputs and assumptions reliable, but also spent a good amount of time discussing why testimony from executives led him to the conclusion that parts of the model were really not a good fit for predicting the impact of this merger. That dispute, or Judge Leon's conclusion there, then that dispute with the DOJ, I think becomes a primary part of the argument in appeal. How one characterizes that dispute. Judge Leon characterizes the dispute over one about inputs into economic models and indeed whether the models fit a particular economic context. Both of those things, obviously, in my view, are part of what economists do, right? We not only write down models and apply them, but also sort of test and think about how those models apply to specific facts. The DOJ characterizes Judge Leon's rejection of the application of models in particular instances as, you know, rejections of economics writ large or rejections of the bargaining model Shapiro employs sort of across the board. We'll turn to that, but in a moment when discussing the DOJ's arguments. But I may have already foreshadowed my view that I certainly don't read Judge Leon's opinion as rejecting economic logic or rejecting bargaining models writ large, but rather sort of taking issue on a factual basis with whether they those models were appropriately applied in the case in front of them, sort of the a standard thing that judges do in Section 7 cases. So Judge Leon's opinion, two other sort of quick notes that I think may be interesting in the appeal level. Two other things that I think are important sources of evidence that he relies upon for his conclusion. One is the court evaluates and discusses, and again, sort of consistent with the rest of the opinion, discusses in pretty great detail evidence about potential efficiencies arising from the transaction, amounting to something along the line of $350 million of efficiencies that conceded by the government. And I think that's an important point for the appeals. The case sort of started off with the acknowledgement that even limiting one's focus to efficiencies arising, one form of efficiencies, those arising from elimination of double marginalization, that you had something like 78 is the number, over $70 million annually in efficiencies passed on to consumers. And I think walking into the case, the idea that the government had acknowledged the burden of needing to show not only that the merger might have some negative downstream impact, but also that that impact would have to outweigh what acknowledged were pretty significant consumer benefits arising from the transaction. I think that is one important part of Judge Leon's opinion. And the other, criticizing Dr. Shapiro's opinion, ends up being a fairly central part of Judge Leon's lengthy analysis. I think it should be noted that the expert testimony that Dr. Carlton on the other side put in, the judge found fairly probative as well. So rather than complicated bargaining models and the like, I mean, Dr. Carlton's testimony, I think, did two things. One, sort of, in a defensive role, sort of poked holes in the predictions arising out of Dr. Shapiro's bargaining model, but also did some analyses on prior transactions, right, on prior vertical transactions in the video programming or distribution industry, and said, listen, you know, the DOJ's model would predict price increases here, but it turned out we didn't get them. And I think Judge Leon sort of points to that testimony as providing yet another reason to think that maybe these sort of more complicated bargaining models, at least applied here, were not probative of predicting the effects of this particular transaction. So for a law and economics person, I think an opinion that gives a lot to think about and a lot to discuss and sort of a welcomed heavy focus on economics. The DOJ's appeal filed in August characterizes Judge Leon's opinion as sort of failing basic economics as sort of the primary argument. And really, I think, at least in my view, makes an attempt to convert some of the judge's conclusions that either, as a matter of fact, the inputs into the model or the model's fit with the industry were lacking into sort of broader errors of logic. So argues Judge Leon's conclusions were sort of meet a clearly erroneous standard because of what the DOJ describes as, and I'll quote, fundamental errors of economic logic and reasoning. So their two major claims are that the DOJ sort of ignores the profit maximization principle. It says DOJ argues Judge Leon's finding that AT&T wouldn't have increased bargaining leverage shows a misunderstanding of that principle. And the Amici Economist brief, I felt like did a pretty good job responding to this point for those interested in reading it. But a firm might have plenty of good reasons to have each division strike its best deal that it can achieve in complex negotiations. The way that firms are structured, it can be, you know, a lot of different ways in which they might be consistent with the profit maximization principle. I think that is a point that the DOJ debates with. But again, I think that that economist Amici brief does a good job discussing that. And for Judge Leon's part with respect to that, you know, points to industry testimony showing sort of precisely why the strategy was used by vertically integrated firms in the industry. So that's sort of one, I think the fundamental tension and issue in the appeal will be the sort of move by DOJ to convert factual disputes and disputes that are based on crediting industry testimony into sort of broader forms of economic error. The second category of argument that falls into that theme is, I think, a pretty interesting one, which is Judge Leon's rejection of the Nash bargaining model. So the way that I read the opinion, and I think certainly the way that it's written, is that Judge Leon says, you know, doesn't reject the use of bargaining models writ large, but rather says the predictions here aren't probative because the inputs and assumptions in the model, either there's factual problems with the inputs or problems with the fit of the model, given industry characteristics that the judge infers from business testimony. So again, here the fundamental tension is DOJ attempts to portray those differences as ones about Judge Leon either abiding by or rejecting fundamental principles of economics. Here again, I think quite a bit of the opinion is devoted, I think 40 pages, to sort of a one-by-one discussion of why inputs into the model were flawed. Some of those flaws conceded at trial and combined with testimony both from the DOJ's own expert and from Dennis Carlton, that tweaking some of those assumptions do away with the prediction that the DOJ offered that the merger would be on net anti-competitive. So again, I think there, the DOJ's most forceful argument is one they make about the threat of blackouts and its influence or potential influence on the bargaining model. They point to a passage in the decision in which, and I think this is sort of exemplifies the nature of the dispute throughout, they point to this passage and say, Judge Leon doesn't believe the threat of blackout is credible because there's a bunch of testimony that suggests it's not. The DOJ attempts to portray that passage as indicating that the judge simply doesn't understand that the threat of a blackout could affect leverage, even if a blackout doesn't exist. Again, I think a read of the opinion, at least the way I read it, suggests that the latter reading, the DOJ reading, is a bit strained in that rather, I think probably the fairest reading and the one I think that the D.C. Circuit is more likely to accept, given Judge Leon's heavy reliance on testimony in front of him during the trial, was that the court understood very well that the threat is important and how that threat related to the DOJ's bargaining theory, but rather its particular application here was a model that didn't fit the facts. Again, I think sort of pretty standard stuff, evaluating a model fit with facts for a judge in a merger case. Let me close with a couple of things that are sort of a hodgepodge of things I think are sort of interesting. You know, I don't view the opinion as one that is particularly critical in terms of breaking new legal ground. It is a very fact-intensive opinion. One looking for guidance in a casebook for a decision that lays out a comprehensive legal framework for evaluating merger decisions might be left disappointed that the opinion sort of lacks that overall framework. But I don't. And that's not a criticism of the opinion itself. I don't think the opinion does much in terms of breaking new legal ground, but rather it's really a deep fact-intensive exercise that appears to weigh economic analysis, you know, and heavier or more significantly than predictions arising from customer testimony or hot documents. I think that's a manner in which, maybe ironically, given the DOJ's arguments, I think really an opinion that is that fact intensive in reviewing the economic analysis in a particular case and favoring it over documents and customer testimony is something consistent with how economists have been arguing mergers ought to be analyzed for some time. I will conclude with the thought that I don't find the result, Judge Leon's result, particularly surprising for a couple of reasons. One is that the number conceded for efficiencies in the transaction, some $350 million, I think when you combine the conceded efficiencies figure, which is quite large, I can't think of an amount of efficiencies recognized by a court sort of that large in a litigated transaction. And if there is, it's sort of a quite a significant number. And again, recall that's a lower bound, right? That is just the eliminating double marginalization efficiencies. I don't think it's particularly surprising when you've got that much in consumer benefit conceded by the party challenging the deal. And when the testimony of the economic expert arguing the merger is anti-competitive is statistically indistinguishable from zero. And that, again, is a point that Judge Leon pointed to in the opinion, and I think comes out, again, in these economist amicus briefs, which I think are definitely worth reading for those interested in following the decision. I mean, those two facts combined, I think statistical harm indistinguishable from zero and some certainty over a high number of efficiencies, I think you know, sort of nothing really surprising in the decision. You know, certainly lots to quibble about, and the DOJ, I think, you know, does what it can to make larger what are really factual disputes over the economic inputs to the model. But for you know, my own personal view, not a ton surprising in the outcome given those two sort of important facts. And I think those facts will matter a great deal in how the Court of Appeals evaluates the transaction as well. Michael, why don't I stop there and let you turn to questions, or we could do whatever's next.
All right. Thank you, Josh. Let's go to audience questions. Not seeing any questions lined up right away. Josh, did you want to expound on anything further while we wait a few minutes for some questions to come in?
Sure. I think, I mean, I said in the opening, the relationship between the outcome of this case and how the agencies will treat vertical mergers going forward. I think there are a couple of interesting components of that. Sort of one question is whether the outcome of this appeal will have much, if anything, to do with how the DOJ in particular, but say both agencies, will you know, will move forward in terms of litigating vertical merger cases. I've seen a sort of a frequently expressed opinion that an appellate loss in AT&T Time Warner, which is, I think, certainly the outcome that I think is most likely, given Judge Leon's opinion, that an appellate loss might slow the DOJ down or might even have some chilling effect on vertical merger enforcement from the FTC. I guess I would say I don't find that outcome particularly likely. I think Assistant Attorney General Del Rahim has, I think for certain, made clear that he is willing to bring cases that he believes in, whether or not the outcome of litigation is as always uncertain. I think he's sort of shown and he's willing to take you know, stances that the DOJ staff and he believe are appropriate. So I can't imagine the DOJ being slowed down at all. I don't think that means they bring more vertical transactions or less. I think that we'll see sort of business as usual from the antitrust division, you know, and sort of not impacted one way or another by a decision that doesn't go their way. I think that's just sort of part of the business and sort of what happens when you are AAG and you bring tough cases. And that's, you know, I think if anything, AAG Del Rahim should be applauded for being willing to bring a tough case that clearly his staff believed in. I think another interesting dimension is this connection to vertical merger guidelines. One of the strongest points in favor of vertical merger guidelines in iterations of that debate that have happened historically, and I think are arising once again. I just heard them come up in the context of the recent FTC hearing panel on vertical mergers, is that both agencies might be open now to guidelines. One of the strongest cases made previously in favor of guidelines was, of course, we didn't have anything litigated, right? We don't have decisions to point to. We don't have sort of an analytical framework set forth for analyzing vertical mergers. And so maybe guidelines would be valuable. I'm not particularly persuaded by the argument that this opinion changes much of that, right? So important, I think an important precedential opinion in the sense that, look, any area of antitrust law where you don't have a litigated case for 40 years and you get one is going to be important. There is going to be important ways in which this decision shapes how other courts look at vertical merger challenges, and I don't think there's any way to avoid that. But in terms of doing something akin to what the horizontal merger guidelines do, sort of operating as a substitute for guidance on an analytical framework as a whole, I don't think that the opinion does that. And so I don't think it does much in terms of swaying the debate over vertical merger guidelines one way or another, although it is frequently sort of invoked on either side of that debate. I think the vertical merger debate and vertical merger guideline debate and the debate over what vertical merger policy ought be sort of moving forward is going to be one that is lively over the next year. And the guidance that the agencies might give to courts on how to assess vertical mergers, I think, is something both agencies are going to be pretty interested in, and I think is a space to watch. But I don't think particularly impacted one way or another too strongly by the outcome of this opinion, or of course, depending on what the Court of Appeals does, by the outcome of the appeal.
And we do have a question lined up currently, so without further ado, let's move to our first question.
Michael, thank you. It's Laura Peterson. Hello, Josh. Josh, I wanted to ask you. Hi. I wanted to ask you about the basis with respect to efficiency for the conclusion that the very high sum of efficiency that was conceded, I think you mentioned $350 million, would in fact, in good part at least, be passed along to consumers. More broadly, I wanted to get your opinion of the utility, if any, of the very constrained definition of efficiencies in the current merger guidelines, and perhaps more broadly, if you have time, you could also touch upon the specifics of the vertical merger guidelines we have now and how you would change them if you were a philosopher king and could do so.
Great. I will. Let me run through all of those. And those are great questions. Thank you. So in most cases, where the agencies or courts are analyzing efficiencies and the extent to which they are passed through to consumers, this can be a fairly complicated part of a bit of economics to do. It usually depends. So there's some amount of efficiencies that are passed on, some amount of cost savings associated with the transaction, and the horizontal merger guidelines in any event. Well, we want to count the part of those that are passed on to ultimate consumers in some way, shape, or form. There are economic methods for sort of estimating or assuming pass-through rates that depend on the slope of the supply and demand curves, but it can be a pretty complicated exercise. Sometimes, instead, agencies or courts are presented with testimony where, we're estimating pass-through of cost savings into prices through empirically examining prior transactions. I think here, and so it's always sort of less than the total cost savings that are passed through, of course. And here, I think Shapiro's model had sort of built in as a merger simulation model, which, you're estimating a demand curve and you've got a supply curve sort of built into the model, right? So the pass-through is a product of the assumptions that the DOJ is putting into the model over the shape of those respective curves. So the pass-through rate is something that, sometimes we get a little bit more fight over in litigated cases or even cases in front of the agency. Here, the conceded amount that was passed through, that's that sort of 70-something, forgive me for not remembering the exact number, but that 70-something per year that was passed through is the amount that was conceded to be passed through to consumers. I imagine one might have a little bit of debate over whether the pass-through rate could even sort of result in a higher number. And again, recall, those are sort of the lower bound on efficiencies, right? That's the accepted amount from eliminating double marginalization. So, we always know the pass-through rate is going to be smaller than the total cost savings. I don't think you had too much of a fight over the precise level of pass-through here. There's this really interesting, feature of, it's clear from Judge Leon's opinion that the efficiencies number mattered, even though I think the right way to think about the opinion, legally is Judge Leon concluding that the evidence put forth by the DOJ didn't satisfy its prima facie burden, right? So we never get to efficiencies, I think, but it is fairly clear from the opinion that, the impact of that number, that Judge Leon certainly credited that evidence and thought that it was important, even though at the end of the day, he also finds that the evidence the DOJ puts forward is not sufficient to dispel its burden at all on showing anti-competitive effect, including and up to sort of failure to show statistical significance of any of its real sort of core harm results. In terms of the guidelines-based questions, the sort of the last two that you mentioned, you know, I think one was about treatment of efficiencies in the horizontal merger guidelines writ large, and the other was about sort of gaps in the current vertical merger guidelines. Look, my view on the horizontal merger guidelines and efficiencies is, you know, we've done a lot of updating of the horizontal merger guidelines, right? The efficiency section, you know, we write them in 92, rewrite them in 92, put in the efficiency section in 97, rewrite them again in 2010. But if you were to hold up the 1997, you know, sort of the first version of the efficiencies guidelines and hold them up next to the 2010 guidelines, you're largely reading the same document, you know, a little bit of altered wording. But the analytical framework is basically the same. And so, and I largely view the 2010 rewrite as, you know, a rewrite aimed at updating tools the agency uses when thinking about its own case, right? So we update the unilateral effects section. We update how much we think about competitive effects versus, say, structural stuff. We update to reflect that we think less about market structure and a little bit more about competitive effects. We update to talk about the shift towards using natural experiments to estimate whatever we can with respect to effects or diversion ratios. But really, the sort of supply side of the guidelines, you know, entry and efficiencies haven't moved. That doesn't quite answer your question about what I would change, but I think there's quite a bit to do there on the entry and efficiencies section. So just for a couple of examples on the efficiencies section, there is a big distinction drawn between marginal cost savings and fixed cost savings, and that distinction is reflexively used inside the agency to say that real fixed cost savings, you know, sort of don't count or are always not cognizable. As a matter of economics, you can think of cases in which that may not necessarily be the right way to think about fixed cost savings. Plenty of people have written about that, but that's sort of one area. Another might be the treatment of out-of-market efficiencies. You know, that also is an area where the guidelines take a pretty hard stance of saying, you know, if you can show real consumer benefits arising from the merger in some ancillary market, we're not going to count those. I think that's an area where, at least in some transactions, actually makes quite a bit of difference. With respect to the vertical merger guidelines, I guess my punchline there is pretty easy. I don't think that they're used, and I don't think that they're influential at all with respect to how the agencies think about conducting analysis of vertical mergers or in the courts. And, you know, I don't think that's a particularly good or bad thing. My own view is both the theory, the theoretical analytical framework for how we think about vertical issues on the, you know, raising rival cost paradigm and all of that, I think that's changed quite a bit since those guidelines were written, as has sort of a you know, the empirical evidence about what we think about how likely vertical issues are to cause competitive harm. I think we know a lot more in terms of both the economics and the empirics than we did at the time of those guidelines. So I'm not I am certainly of the view that something could be written down to better reflect the modern understanding of vertical transactions. You know, I do have some sympathy for the argument that, you know, that you hear sometimes from the agencies who tell you, we already know how to do these. We have a framework and we don't litigate these that often. So why write down guidelines to influence courts if we're going to litigate them once every 40 years? I mean, as a matter of resource allocation. But, you know, vertical merger challenges are going to become a bigger part of antitrust enforcement than having the agencies invest in, you know, educating courts on how they think about that. And I think is a fine idea to be discussed by the agencies, and one that I think will sort of continue to happen at these hearings and maybe be a more prominent conversation of antitrust policy discussions for the next couple of years.
Thank you, Josh. And I had a question as well. It seemed like Judge Leon was at least open to the argument, or even supportive of the argument AT&T was making, that to view this merger in the context of the rapid changes in the media landscape with new companies like Netflix and Hulu, and also new arrivals of Google and Amazon. How do you see that argument playing out in the higher courts? And also, what do you think that means, if anything, for the other kind of big merger in the pipeline with T-Mobile and Sprint?
I don't really take a strong view to its implication on sort of other transactions. I think it is fairly clear the exercise that the court was engaging in was, you know, a very transaction-specific analysis. But with respect to the former, question, there's no doubt. I think the court pointed to what appears to be sort of a pretty dynamic content market as being, you know, something that the judge pointed to as sort of evidence that, you know, some of the predictions of the bargaining model and the underlying anti-competitive theory were sort of less persuasive. I think Judge Leon's analysis on that speaks for itself. I mean, I think he spent a lot of time writing and documenting the testimony that he heard with respect to sort of that dynamism and how it played out in his opinion. But with respect to its impact on appeal, I don't think much either way, to be honest. I mean, I think the outcome of the appeal is going to be, is the court persuaded by DOJ's arguments that Judge Leon's sort of long detailed analysis of inputs into the model and scrutiny of whether the model fit the facts of the industry, are those the types of error that are fact-based and consistent with economic analysis on the one hand, or are they, you know, evidence of some, you know, large gap in understanding of fundamental antitrust and economic principles? My own view, I think it is difficult to read the opinion as in the manner suggested by the DOJ appeal. My own view of the appropriate role of economists certainly includes scrutiny of inputs into the model and questioning and testing even whether, you know, we call these robustness checks in economics papers, right? Whether the model fits the facts or whether slight tweaks make results go away. I think in many ways what Judge Leon's opinion did was invite and conduct robustness checks on Dr. Shapiro's testimony and ultimately find it lacking. One can disagree on the merits or read different documents differently, but that's not what gets you wins on appeal. What gets you wins on appeal is sort of category error, methodological error, sort of clear error. And I don't think you can get that out of what amounts to sort of a robustness check that Judge Leon conducted on the primary piece of evidence in front of him being Dr. Shapiro's prediction.
I see. Thank you. We have one more question lined up, so without further ado, we'll move to the next question.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Wright. Really appreciate the talk. One question I had is, you know, in his opinion, Judge Leon did note that there was some, we'll say, support among some of the D.C. Circuit judges, Judge Kavanaugh, Judge Ginsburg, for a presumption that, you know, most vertical mergers are going to be pro-competitive absent a showing of market power. But he ultimately sidestepped that question, said, I don't need to go that far. What are your thoughts as to the likelihood that the D.C. Circuit might take this as an opportunity to address whether there should be such a presumption, or is the court going to stick very narrowly to just, we're going to look at what he did viewing the facts, and that's all we're going to say?
That's a great question and an interesting one. Look, most of the analytical writing, I mean, when you point to, Bork and my good friend and co-author and colleague Doug Ginsburg and their, what they've written on vertical restraints and vertical mergers, you know, it was a while ago, right? And I think the inquiry over whether a presumption of legality is warranted is one that necessarily has to be based on empirics. You know, it's necessarily got to be based on what the empirical record shows with respect to the effects of vertical mergers. Now, I've written this elsewhere. My own view is if one engaged in that exercise, and in fact, the Global Antitrust Institute, the sort of outfit that I run, just submitted a comment to the FTC hearings that makes this point. We sort of review all of the evidence of vertical transactions for the past 40 years and try to summarize what those data say. My own personal view is that the evidence on the competitive effects of vertical mergers is consistent with some kind of rebuttable presumption of legality, you know, and certainly want sort of more of a presumption that exists in sort of the existing framework. But that's my personal read of the evidence. I don't think that anything in Judge Leon's opinion suggests there was a sort of search and review of all of that evidence that would give the D.C. Circuit a hook for that kind of. I would think that would be quite an adventurous trip from what exists as the already kind of heavy fact-intensive record. It's a direction that I think the law might go over time, but my own view is I would find that sort of opinion from the D.C. Circuit unlikely. I think the opinion is pretty much built for an appellate. Judge Leon's opinion is pretty much built for a D.C. Circuit opinion that says Judge Leon reviewed the evidence carefully and came to conclusions that the plaintiff didn't meet its burden. We see no clear error. You know, goodbye. And I think that's the safest way to write the opinion. I think you may get more than that, you know, but I would be surprised if you got a lot more than that. And I think sort of writing into the D.C. Circuit's approach to vertical mergers, a presumption based on, you know, sort of an understanding of the overall body of evidence would be, and maybe you can pull that from amicus briefs. It's an interesting idea. I'm a little skeptical they get that adventurous, but you know, one I would. For my own personal view, be sort of welcome to see.
Thank you very much.
All righty. Well, on the behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.